another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damon Abraham, and once again, I am bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, breaking format yet again, and I have not one, but two guests from an amazing band. I have Frederick and Nicola from Millencolin, two friends of mine, two people that happen to play in an amazing band that I grew up being obsessed with. And so, yeah, they came over to my house, and more on that in a second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to DamianAbraham.com. There's an email address. You can send me an email there if you are so inclined. I battle with it, you know? I'm battle trying to get back to you. So if you need to get in touch with me immediately, head over to Facebook.com. If you use Facebook, and you can like the Turned Out of Punk Facebook page. It's run by my brother, Tristan, and you can send him a message. He'll get the message to me, and we can go from there. You can also go over to various forms of social media and follow me at Left 4 Damian. And yeah, that'd be awesome and a great way to get in touch with me. And if you are wanting to support this show, a great way to do that would be by subscribing to this. If you use iTunes, you can do that. And then also if you use iTunes, how about rating this podcast and writing a review for it? If you don't use iTunes, or if you don't feel like doing that, you can please tell your friends if you enjoy this podcast and help spread the word, because that's great. And then your friends will know about this podcast and they can listen. Also, if you do subscribe to this podcast, you will be kept abreast about all the other podcasts that are coming out in the Turned Out of Punk universe. And I'm not just talking about Footnotes, which is an amazing podcast hosted by myself and Chris O'Toole, where each week we go in depth about the Turned Out of Punk episode and dissect it and talk about records and record pressings and bands and all sorts of weird stuff on that. There's a very active mailbag on that show and a fun community kind of around that show where people participate in the show. It's anyway, go check that one out. But no, I'm also talking about the other new podcast in this podcast universe, which is Tom Bryan and My Clobberin' Time, which is a podcast dealing with pro wrestling. We will be having music guests on, or guests from the world of music, I should say, to talk about the sweet, sweet, sweet graps that pro wrestling, that for some reason, I wouldn't say overwhelming number of musicians, but certainly a surprising number of musicians happen to be very excited about. So that should be a great podcast as it grows, you know? And I'm saying that as a member of that podcast, but you should listen to it because I think you might enjoy it if you do like pro wrestling. If you don't like pro wrestling, then don't download it. Do not download it. And don't worry. Eventually, it's going to be moved off this feed. So if you don't like wrestling, you will not have to think about wrestling until I have, of course, another pro wrestler on the show, which I plan on doing. Oh my gosh, do I plan on doing that? But not today, because today on the show, I have an amazing pair of guests from a band called Millencolin. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Millencolin, they are, I would say, one of the biggest punk bands out of Sweden. Definitely one of the biggest punk bands out of Sweden. They've won awards there. They've, you know, toured all over the world. And they are certainly one of my favorite bands to kind of come out of that melodic punk sound of the late 90s. I love this band. I'm still, you know, and I bring it up in this episode. I have all their CD EPs because they didn't put out a lot of vinyl early on my shelf still. And they are a great band. They can write one heck of a pop punk song. So I was a big fan. And then lo and behold, in high school, a friend of mine, Mike Fedorovich, a little bit older than me, but turns out his cousin was the lead singer of this band, Nicola. So I got to meet them when I was in high school and kind of had an in. And they gave me a hat and it was awesome. And so, yeah, fast forward, what is it, almost 20 years now? Yeah, probably 20 years now. I'm on tour with them in Australia. You know, I get to see them a lot and it's awesome. And we are friends. And how cool is that? So when they were in town to visit Mike, they said, let's do this. And I said, yes, please. And they came over to my house. Frederick and Nicola came here. We sat down, we discussed, and it is a fun conversation. And it really discusses a lot about a scene that I have always wanted to kind of know the germination of, which is the sort of 90s melodic hardcore scene in Sweden, which you know, begets a lot of other stuff too. But we'll get into all that in this episode. So everyone, please sit back, relax, and enjoy a break in format, but it's well worth it. Actually, before I do that, I should do the corrections. First of all, I have no idea if Johan Kugelberg actually signed Superchunk. I say that in this. I don't know where I got it from. He was working at Matador at the time, but whether or not he was, you know, actually key to the signing of Superchunk, I do not know. So I don't know why I say that in here. Also, I have no idea what band I'm talking about that the lead singer of No Fun at All was in, because I cannot find any mention of it. I remember someone at a record store, I'm not going to say who it was, telling me that when I was a kid, but he might have been fucking with me as a kid because he had a tendency to do that back then. Also, it might be a tad bit confusing what's going on in this interview because there are so many people in the room. So the first person that you hear talk is Frederick. And then after that, you'll hear Nicola. And also Mike Vitorovich, my friend from high school, was in the room too. So you'll hear me refer to him just so you know kind of what's going on, you know, before it all happens. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Frederick and Nicola from Mill and Colin on Turned Out a Punk. We can talk about records all day. There's actually like a bunch of good records that was not too far from here too. So we should do a fast interview so we can go do that. Guys, I want to thank you so much for coming here. This is like a huge thrill. Like, as Mike can attest, in high school, this would be like a fantasy for me, having Mill and Colin in my house. Well, like, you know, two members of Mill and Colin in my house, but that's two better than I had in high school, you know?
Thank you for having us.
No, it's awesome to have you.
Great being here.
We're big fans of your band.
Well, I'm a massive fan of your band, so that's a big thing to hear. And all your bands. You're in multiple amazing bands. We can get into that. And also, you're in multiple amazing bands, too. Well, solo project and solo stuff, but then also precursor bands too.
Exactly.
But we'll get into all that in a second. But I guess it's weird now doing it with two people, because I have like a weird format for the show that I always like to try and keep, which is asking how you got into punk. But with two of you here, I guess I'm going to have to do it twice.
Yeah.
So.
Or maybe our stories will be sort of linked.
Maybe. Well, I'm sure they will link up at a certain point.
Yeah.
But I imagine they have two very different starting points of how you got into punk, right?
Probably, we never really talked about that, I guess.
Do we know how we actually met?
Through Eric and Matthias and the skateboarding thing.
But this would have been before that, though, where you first heard about punk.
Which
one of you, I guess, you know, without giving away your age, which one of you is older?
That's me.
So let's start with you first.
I think my first memory is probably going to one of my cousins. I think I was like 9 or 10.
Okay.
And I'd be like, yeah, that was like early 80s, 82, 83, something. And he was all into heavy metal and all that stuff at first. And then this time when I got to him, he had his room, like, he had posters of all these punk bands, GBH, Exploited, and Discharge, and naked girls. So I just, and he had cut a mohawk, and I was just thinking, what the hell is this? This is, he's dangerous nowadays. And he was a wrestler too, so he was always starting with wrestling me down. But I always, he was kind of my guy to ask about new music.
Yeah.
So.
Was metal, like, I guess metal was the dominant kind of music at that point, right? Was it a little bit or no?
My first band I got into really hard was Iron Maiden.
Okay, yeah.
And so, but I used to ask him, like, can you tell me the difference between hard rock and heavy metal? What's it? Forget about that. It's punk. That's the new cool stuff.
Yeah, Regaré is a bunch of motherfuckers now.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I saw his posters of GBH and heard that stuff. And once I heard it, it wasn't that big of a difference from like the early Maiden stuff and that stuff. And then, but I continued to listen to heavy metal, I guess, until like 12, 13 maybe. And I remember visiting like, because we were training school when we got like 14 years old.
Like high school.
Seventh grade.
And we went to their cafeteria, and they were playing Asta Kask.
Oh, fucking awesome.
And Onkel Konkel, have you heard about that band?
Yeah.
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah.
No band sounds like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's a one-man project.
Oh, is one guy doing all that?
Yeah.
I've only heard it on a tape. Someone made me a crazy Swedish hardcore deep cut mixtape once.
So that's when I really got into punk, hearing this, like Asta Kask, the Swedish stuff.
Yeah.
And I fell in love with that directly then. And that must have been like 88, maybe.
So I guess at that point, was that music, how popular would it have been in Sweden at the time? Like, was it like, it would have been like, would it have been underground, I guess? Or was it like...
Yeah, we had a place in our town where all these bands, I guess they came through there, but I didn't know about them until then.
Yeah.
Maggot.
Yeah.
All these bands. I mean, international bands too, like... You remember?
Yeah, we saw Afghan Whigs. There was a lot of shows pretty much every weekend there.
Yeah.
And that's where, even though we didn't really go to all the shows, we hung out outside, and that's where all the punks met, and you know, we were just drinking. And then for the last half hour, they would actually open up the doors so you can get in for free and see this sort of encore part of the shows. And some of those bands actually became later, like, we became fans of those bands, like Afghan Whigs, for instance. We didn't go to the show, but we saw the encore, and then Matthias got really hooked, and then it became his favorite band. And
yeah.
So you just kind of like go to any show just because that's the spot to hang out.
Yeah.
And let it take you what takes you, type thing.
Yeah. And if they were good, or you became a fan, and I guess, of course, at some point you actually knew the bands before, because
mostly like the Swedish bands, like, you know, Union Carbide Productions.
Well, like that, I guess that's the, because it's like sonically, you know, I obviously tend to associate Swedish hardcore with, like, you know, that specific like buzzsaw Swedish kind of like DB influenced, type thing. But then there's also like, Union Carbide Productions, like a garage rock, like amazing rock band. That's also how much did the scenes kind of commingle at that point? Was it like, were like the same sort of kids? Would you have like the kids with the charged hair going to see them, or no?
I think it was kind of separated.
Separate scenes, yeah.
Because the whole crust thing was a scene by its own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Could you like intermingle, or was it like if you were a crust kid, you were a crust kid, and
you could kind of like Asta Kask and Anti-CMX and like them both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
I didn't really understand the crust part though.
No. No.
I was all about the melodic bands and you had some crust people who were looking down on the sort of Big Imp and
that was kind of the second wave of Swedish crust punk.
Yeah.
Like, you know, No Security and Totalitarian.
Yeah.
Not Totalitarian, they were early, but No Security and
Rumsfeld. I think
they were early too.
That single's fucking
up. Sweden's Poison Idea.
Yeah. They are awesome. That single's incredible. I guess also because we brought up Union Carbide Productions. Did you know Johan Kugelberg? You know the guy that would. Did you know Johan?
Johan Kugelberg.
He would be the first A&R guy for Matador Records.
Yeah. Well, his actually that's funny that you mentioned, because
infamous record collector.
His brother is from Örebro.
Oh, he is.
And he's called. Well, and he told me, because we were massive Superchunk fans.
Yeah.
So, and he told us that his brother went to the States and worked for...
Yeah, I think he might have signed Superchunk, too.
I know his brother kind of a little bit.
Oh, cool.
Well, I guess this would be a great point, Nicola, to kind of turn it over to you. And how did you getting to punk? Do you remember the first time you kind of came across it?
Well, I guess I first have to explain tell how. I mean, back in the 80s is when I started to listen to music.
Yeah.
And in Sweden at that point, it was either you liked heavy metal, as Fredrik just mentioned, or you liked like pop music, like Howard Jones and Duran Duran and that kind of.
Yeah.
So it was very sort of divided. And so, and at that point when I was maybe went first or second grade, my Canadian cousin, Michael's older brother, he sent me or gave me a Jimi Hendrix vinyl, Are You Experienced? So that was my first vinyl, and then I got into Iron Maiden and Michael Jackson at the same time. So those are sort of three bands or artists I was into. But then, and then later in the second part of the 80s, I became, I started liking hip-hop a lot.
Okay.
Rap music.
Yeah, yeah.
Gangster rap, like Ice-T, Public Enemy. And so I was into that a bit too. Also, a lot thanks to my Canadian cousin.
Was it coming from your cousin who was sending you this stuff? Like, was it on Swedish TV at that point, or was it on?
No, I mean, Sweden was still very much heavy metal and the synth, as we say.
Yeah, yeah. Because now it's really obviously hip hop's huge everywhere. Yeah, there's a huge Swedish.
No, I mean, I first got to hear about Eric B. and Rakim, and
yeah.
And Public Enemy would probably know him, but Ice-T,
yeah.
Ice-T Power, that album was a big, it was mind-blowing to me just to hear that. So I was a lot into that. But then at the same time when I started seventh grade, skateboarding came.
Mm-hmm.
And me and all my friends started, you know, skateboarding. And through skateboarding, we just, all the skaters were into Misfits, you know,
mm-hmm.
Ramones and Suicidal Tendencies and bands like that. And so that's when I started to listen to punk rock, I guess. And then the more we skated, the more I found out about also the Swedish scene, like Astakask, Strebers, and those kind of melodic Swedish punk bands. And And then later on, through the skateboard videos and movies, we got more and more into American bands, Operation Ivy, and later on Bad Religion and NoFX and that whole thing. And then eventually we started Millencolin and through that. And
well, you're leaving out some steps. We're gonna get to. Okay. We gotta get some other steps there. We can't, on this show. We gotta talk about your obscure 7 inches. That's like the bread and butter of this thing.
But one of the reasons why I actually got hooked on punk rock was actually not so much the international bands and the biggest Swedish bands. It was actually what was happening in the local scene. Because some of the skateboarding guys that I got to know through skateboarding, I just realized that they were all creative and playing music.
Mm-hmm.
And not, you know, sort of technical heavy metal stuff. It was actually something completely different. And when I heard the first Shakis Rebeller, the singer from The Accidents.
Okay.
Like first bander.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, when I heard that, that was for me the big sort of game-changing, or the big moment for me. I just realized, this is so incredibly cool. He's actually writing songs about, you know, everything he sees around him and just making these amazing punk rock songs. And I just thought, if he can do this, because I realized it's not that complicated and the words were kind of genius, but still simple. I just realized, if he can do it, maybe I can, you know.
Had you been playing? When did you start playing music? Like, when did you first play?
Well, my two older brothers, they were the talented sort of guys in the family. They knew how to play guitars and they had bands and they were always.
Were they in punk bands at all or no?
No, they were more, you know, they liked my one brother was a huge Kiss fan.
Okay, yeah.
Which I thank him today for, because I
could do that. Worse.
Yeah, yeah. I love Kiss now.
Yeah.
But then it was his band.
Yeah.
I couldn't touch it pretty much. But then, so they were all into heavy metal, basically, and had those bands. So, and I just realized I can't play guitar like that. It's never gonna happen. I was too lazy to practice the guitar, so I could basically play Smoke on the Water when I got into punk rock.
Well, that's more than I can play. Do you remember actually what was the actual first band you went to, first show you saw?
A punk rock show.
Yeah. I guess any concert was the first concert.
Well, my first concert, I thought I was gonna die actually, before I entered the big stadium, or big stadium, it was hockey stadium, Europe.
Oh yeah,
Europe, the final countdown.
Yeah, dun 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 dun. One of my favorite wrestlers.
Yeah,
you were at that show too.
Yeah, yeah.
But we didn't know each other. But it was crazy. Everyone was there, and to me that was my first show. But then I think the first punk rock show was probably one of those local punk rock shows. And it was, yeah, I saw you, maybe you played up in Hovsta, a small punk show.
Yeah, we played there.
Yeah.
Well, I guess, Frederick, to take it back to yourself, when do you remember going to your first punk rock show? Do you remember your very first show?
I probably went to like the heavy metal shows, the big heavy metal shows first. And then
do you remember your very first show?
I think might have been a synth show.
Oh, awesome.
Really?
Indochine. The French band Indochine.
Yeah.
And then Europe. And then Yngwie Malmsteen and those bigger. Because Örebro is based very good. I mean, we have 2 hours to Stockholm.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Fagersta put up amazing shows to like French band.
Yeah, it's right in the middle, so you can get to a lot of towns and cities quite easily.
And that, I guess there was the other thing is, you know, there's, you know, like everywhere else, there's such distinct punk scenes that kind of form in every city. And so I guess you had access to all of them. Or not all of them.
But I guess we
Mia's kind of far.
I guess we formed our own punk scene.
Yeah, and then you had your own.
Yeah, we did. But I mean, we had contact with other cities.
Yeah.
And other distros, fanzines, and all that stuff. And we were always doing everything by ourselves.
Well, how old were you when you first started playing music? Do you remember, like
14, 15, maybe? Okay. And was it kind of a mix of punk, thrash? I didn't even know how to play.
Yeah.
Because I started this band. We gave it the name Gastric Flu.
Okay.
Before we even started to rehearse or anything.
Yeah.
But I remember the first time we were supposed to rehearse, and we got in there, and our set list was like Skulls by Misfits, Hang the Pope by Nuclear Assault, and something more, United Forces by SOD.
What a sick band!
But I had all these drums, but I mean, I had no clue how to play it. So I just went as fast as I could on the snare drum, and the other guys would just stop. They stopped playing and looking at me. What are you doing? And then some nice older guy there at the rehearsal space came in and showed me something there.
So was it a rehearsal space where you could just go and rent by the hour, and they had like
you needed, you had to pay like $100 a year.
Okay.
And you get to
access borrow. To
And this is one of the
and recording their studio and everything.
Yeah,
and this is one of the things. I think it's a big reason why so many bands from Sweden can come out and actually record and be active, because we have this system where you actually you get the more you rehearse, you would fill in forms and just tell the
organization.
Yeah.
That you administrators,
were, that you were doing it like 3 times a week, and they would actually give you time in the studio.
Oh, that's awesome!
So yeah, and you paid like $100
a year. Yeah,
that's a million times better system than we have in Canada for our supporting arts. As Mike and I can attest, the way it works here,
I know.
If you're an established artist, you get more money. So the more established you are. So it's not really helping these young bands.
Yeah. And they had, I mean, the rehearsing rooms were, you know, you had the amps, you had the drums, everything was just there. You just came in and I mean, we didn't know, I didn't know how to, in our first band, nobody knew how to play. So, and they were there, you know, the guys who were organizing it were there, you know, drinking coffee and came in and like, yeah, showed us how to play the drums and
tune the guitars and
especially that part. It took us a while.
I remember actually Pear from Bruce Banner and Protest Bank telling us about that system, and just when we were like, when we first played with Bruce Banner, and just being like, oh my god, that sounds like such a great system to foster young musicians. Like, there's a system for you to go in and have access to this sort of stuff, whereas, you know, like now it's, there's so much startup cost to playing music. You've got to get a guitar first. That costs a lot of money.
Yeah, for us, it was just basically just one day, just went in there and sort of signed the paper and then just started.
That's awesome. So were like these older, were the older bands, like you mentioned, having contacts with some of these other bands, were they like mentoring you when you first started? Or no, not really?
No, no, not really.
Probably.
No. As you said, we were kind of
by ourselves.
Our own scene back in Örebro.
I mean, we were. I mean, there weren't really any other older punk rock bands, because when we started, I mean, I looked up to you and your band, and you were the same age.
Yeah.
And that's where the sort of mentor thing came in. I mean, I went to hang out, just watching you guys rehearse, like just hearing those songs, and just sort of try to figure out how you guys, you know, play it and wrote the songs and some Danne Wall, who was one of the main guys, had Shakers Rebeller, as I mentioned before, was later on Accidents and a lot of other bands that you probably know better.
Yeah, Anstalt, and it's his new band. He lives in Austria.
Oh, Anstalt. Oh yeah, absolutely.
So that guy, and he was one of the, you know, top 10 skateboarders in Sweden too.
Well, I guess that's the other thing, is like Swedish hardcore is so, after a certain point, so tied to skateboarding. I guess not really the crust scene, but
yeah, it was all linked, and but he actually wrote, when we started the band, we had the name, we had like the logos way before we started rehearsing. So and I was actually not in the band, but they have been talking about Seigman, the band, for a while before they actually did something. So I knew about it. I had seen the stickers and Danne Wall actually wrote our first song.
Oh really?
Yeah. So like,
he gave it to you.
This is and this is how you do it. Like sort of. And we're like, okay, should you just take four random sort of notes or chords? It wasn't really chords, but you know.
Yeah.
And just and then there were the guy in your band, Håkansson, John.
John, yeah.
I think he actually made a system for writing those punk rock songs. You just took dice, you know. I wrote like, okay, six and then four. Okay, so fourth, like sixth thread, fourth string, like, but hit that note and then the dice again and sort of, and that's how we wrote.
That's all, for real? That's how you guys wrote that?
I mean, that's, yeah.
Is there, are there songs on the 7-inch that are written like that?
No.
I don't know.
Or maybe just, this was
earlier before that. So yeah, what happened? Gastric Flu. You guys, did you play shows as Gastric Flu?
No, we didn't. I knew that I'm not going to be able to play like thrash metal and that speed metal, whatever. So we split up the band, and I formed a band with John, that guy with the dice, and two other guys, and we started to play Swedish punk rock.
What was that band called?
Antibanadots.
Okay.
And that became Kung Fu.
Okay, did you guys put out anything as the first?
I think we did a demo.
A demo tape. So was there a big cassette culture? Because I guess Millen Collins' first two things are cassettes, and then also you guys did a cassette in the first band. Did you guys do a cassette as Kung Fu too?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We actually did three in the first half year.
In Millen Collins?
No, Seigman.
And Seigman, you did three tapes?
Yeah, well, the first one we put out, we recorded in December, third one in June.
Okay.
or in May. So
wow, and then you did the seven. When did the 7-inch? When was that recorded?
That was during that first year, but in the summertime. So during the first, I guess, like 9 months, we or maybe even less, we recorded 3 demo tapes of like 9 to 10 songs, and then the 7-inch.
So when the 7-inch, you guys self-released it, right?
Yeah, we formed a sort of half fictive label called KGB.
Yeah, KGB Records.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how did you guys know to put out vinyl? Like, had you seen other bands do it? Like, were you on KGB too?
No. We had our own thing.
You had your own self-release too.
The Pong Records.
Yeah, and it came out first, right?
Yeah.
Put out yours first?
I think so.
Yeah. And we just, I mean...
I mean, the tape thing was huge.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, even from the second half of the 80s, I was all into the tape trading all around the world. Like, thrash metal tapes and later the death metal stuff and that. So that was, I mean, that's how you do it. I thought when we had a band and we gotta do a demo, send out to people.
Yeah,
and then I don't know.
I guess there was like a trading. There's a demo trading culture too in Swedish hardcore.
Yeah,
I guess there was like a lot because I guess it was connected to the thrash metal scene where it comes from. Because you don't really see it as much in, there's like obviously mixtape culture, but not nearly the same idea of like trading demo tapes and making mixtapes with tons of demos on them. Is it more from the metal scene, do you think, that kind of came?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Most of the punk bands, they went straight to singles.
Yeah.
To 7-inches.
Yeah.
And I guess...
Yeah, but we did... demos was the big thing for us.
Because it was much cheaper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was cool because...
And we could do everything ourselves.
Yeah. Trade what you met the other bands, but mostly just sell them at school and make some money to
record the next one.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yep, the same scam every band's using till this day.
Yeah. Yeah, but I guess I probably somebody told me how to and where to get in touch to make the 7-inches.
Yeah.
So we thought that nobody's gonna put this out, so let's do it ourselves.
Yeah.
There was no label, like bigger, like real label that you could think of.
Well, really?
I mean...
Like the really fast records and
stuff? Well, I guess like you had Bird Nest and... But that, they were in another league. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Those bands, Untouchables, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Karta 77, Strebers.
Yeah. De Lyckliga Kompisarna.
Yeah.
So
stuff like that.
I guess, like, at what point do you guys kind of meet? Because you form Millencolin first, and you don't join until, like, the second year, right?
No, I joined, like, after a couple of months.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you on the first tape?
No, okay. The second tape,
yeah. Okay.
Well, I mean, we met through when you had Anti-Banadots, and then you started Kung Pung.
Yeah. Yeah, that Kung Pung single is so raging.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's awesome.
And I prefer the demo.
I've never heard the demo. Well actually, maybe I've heard just the YouTube tracks.
But then
again,
the first demo is always the best.
Not with my band.
With my band either, I can tell you.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes it has to get a little... Sometimes we're growers, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, but we... I mean, you had Kung Pung and you had the demo and you were one of the three big punk rock bands. It was Kung Pung, Charles Hårfager, which Eric in the band was playing and writing songs and playing guitar.
What were they like? What was the vibe of that band?
The same kind of style.
Where does the melody come from? Like, you know, like in because obviously, like, you know, Mob 47 and Anti-Cinex, it's like so
blatant. When we started Kung Pung, it was definitely from Astakask.
I guess they were the melodic.
Astakask and Strebers were the two... I mean, those were the two bands that you sort of looked up to, because they were kind of not too complicated. I mean, you could sort of figure out, and the melodies were super catchy, and you could sort of figure out how they wrote those songs. At least Astakask, Strebers had some guitar melodies that were kind of a bit more technical, but very good. But then And then you had De Lyckliga Kompisarna, which was really, really good. But that was, like, too technical. That guy was inspired by classical music.
Yeah.
And we're like, whoa, this we're never going to reach to this point. So for me, it was more the three big local bands. As I mentioned, Kung Pung, Charles Hårfager, which is Eric's band, and then Shakers Rebeller, which is Danne Wahls.
Yeah.
And those were the three bands I looked up to. And then I had heard Shakespeare's Rebeller's first demo. And after that, Sagman started. And we went to a show the day after I finished first grade in high school.
Okay.
So,
like, first year of...
So I'm actually 16, about to turn 17.
Okay.
And I'm not in the band. And... I'm just skating, and I go to the show to see. I think you played in Hofstra, or
yeah,
and Charles Hårfager played, and then and there, and that's my first punk rock show actually.
Okay,
and Matthias, also a Millencolin member, who started Sagman, but they had only rehearsed like twice. He asked me, "Do you want to?" We need, because the singer can't play bass and sing. Well, he can't do neither, but at this point, he just figured out we need someone who can actually play the bass and let him just sing.
Yeah.
So, and he knew that my, you know, brothers could play guitar, so he figured that I was, you know, talented enough. And I was
in the genes.
And I was in the skateboarding scene, and we were friends, so it was a natural thing for me to ask, for him to ask me, and that's how I started. Playing in Sagman, but at that point I don't think, and then eventually, like a few months afterwards, this is the summer of 91, and in December we record our first demo, and then we sort of, that's how I get to meet you guys in Kung Pung, and because you rehearse at the same place, and
so
that's how we. Martin.
So how did the transition come? Because it's really, you know, Millencolin starts 92, right?
Yeah.
So that's like a short period for like the two bands to kind of be like right up against each other. How did that transition kind of happen between the two bands?
Well, we started summer 91, and then everything, we were so, you know, inspired and just had all these ideas. And there were no like frames to what we could do. We were just like open and free to do. I mean, we had... obvious inspiration of the other bands, other local bands, and so we had, and you could write songs about, you know, kids in school that you hated, you know, and that's what we did, you know, we had all these songs about, you know, the jocks and also the, like the Ku Klux Klan in the state, you know, it was everywhere,
wide reaching.
Yeah, everything that we thought, you know, stinked, we would. Write a punk rock song about it.
Yeah,
and so, and we start in like June and December. We record the first demo, March 2nd demo, and then as I said, May 3rd demo, and then, and on the third demo, it's actually interesting because when we started, we were into the Swedish singing local bands and Asta Kask Stebers. But then that year something happens and we get more and more inspired by Bad Religion, NoFX, that American kind of Southern Californian punk rock melodic style. And on the third demo, I actually, Matthias is singing on the second and the third one. But on the third one, because I write most of the songs on that demo, so I just, there's one song that I write in English, and that's sort of the transition, because then the 7-inch that we record later that summer, because I sing, for some reason, I sing on that song on the demo, and not Matthias, and then I tell him later on that okay, because I liked how I sang on that song, so like, singing is might be something for me too. So I just said, okay, from now on, the songs that I write, I would like to sing them.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, but then you have to sing all the songs. Like, okay. And that's how I actually became the singer.
Oh, really?
because Matthias was singing before in Sidemen, and so later, like a month afterwards, we record the 7-inch, and it's all English songs.
Yeah.
So that's in the summer, and then I don't know if that letter, because there's another band called Sidemen in Norway.
Yeah.
I don't. Maybe it's the same summer they found out about us, and they actually send me a letter, like, you guys need to change name, or you know, because we have this name. And I'm not sure if that's the reason why we...
Does it mean anything, or is it just like...
It's a candy, you know, like...
Oh, okay.
Sidemen, like...
Like toffee or taffy or something, or...
Oh, what is that, like, when something is...
stretchy?
Yeah, like stretchy men.
Okay, okay.
That's the canon.
And it's like, I guess it's like in Norway and in Sweden. Or
I'm not sure if they based their name on the candy, but we did.
I think it's spelled slightly differently. It's like one different
N, yeah, or something. I think they have one N and we have two
N's. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Anyways, but
not that it didn't work out in your favor anyway, so.
Now, and I'm not sure if that's the reason why we start Millencolin. I guess we just want to separate the two things, because in Sidemen at that time, we were actually... I think we were four, five members, and then in high school we just realized that it's me, Matthias, and Eric. We're in the same school, and we're like super fans of Bad Religion and NoFX and Operation Ivan, and we just want to start that kind of band. And for some reason, we wanted to separate, because I guess Sidemen came from, you know, the sort of Swedish punk rock style,
yeah,
which was to us completely different, because that thing didn't have anything to do with skateboarding, and this was our, you know, skatecore, you know, skate punk band.
Yeah.
Even though that term was not really used at the point, we wanted a band, a skateboard band.
Yeah.
So we had, and Eric, who does all the designs, he immediately, you know, on the first demo, was a skateboarding guy. And
so, yeah, like, I guess,
was the cover, and
when from skateboarding videos, that's where you heard, like, all these American bands? Like, were they coming through much at this point? Or, like, was NoFX touring Europe? Bad Religion definitely was, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
NoFX would have been, right? It would have been, like, Ribbed?
Yeah, but probably not up in
yeah, that's maybe true.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure when...
I think they did their first tour, like, in 94 or something in Sweden, right? 95?
Those shows were with us, then.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if they came before. I doubt it, but maybe they did. But.
Yeah. Well, I guess which brings up a good question. Like, as far as like international touring bands, like, who would have come through? The Doughboys, probably. Did the Doughboys play?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. And like, were there a lot of like North American bands? I guess that's why Swedish. I guess like all the scenes are so distinct and develop so perfectly in their own way, is because there wasn't so much like influence like in Canada from American bands coming over here, you know, like that's why you have like such a distinct like, oh, this is, yeah, Swedish hardcore, this, yeah, is like,
well, for us, we were, I mean, when we started Millencolin, it was all about
the American people stuff.
Yeah. I mean, we wanted to sound
like, I mean, early on though, yeah, it was definitely
so, and I guess that's why we started that band separately,
yeah,
because that was the, we shared the same vision, me, Eric, and Matthias. This is what we want to do. And it was very obvious that we didn't want anything to do with any other bands than maybe like five bands.
Yeah.
You were US hardcore at that time.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what,
the modern equivalent.
Yeah. That's what we're calling the band.
Was,
yeah,
it called US hardcore? That was the thing that was...
Yeah, we didn't know what it was, but we saw these American bands.
Yeah.
They call themselves US hardcore. So
yeah,
that's us.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we said in the beginning, I guess. I mean, yeah.
And after that first demo, I booked the band to a show at the, where we had the rehearsal space.
Uh-huh.
We could use the studio. We built a stage in there. And I booked these guys and, you know, the Swedish band The Past.
Okay.
So I booked them, and my sound tech got too drunk, so he went home. So I had to do the sound on them, that first show. And then I guess you guys started to talk about having a second guitar in the band.
Yeah, I mean, Matthias, in the first band, he was never playing the drums, but he knew how to play it, and since it was me, Eric, and Matthias, who had this idea of Millencolin, we just figured out that Eric was a guitar player, and Matthias was the only guy who could actually play drums, and I would sing, and that was what we knew, and I guess it didn't turn out that, I mean, he was pretty good on drums, but I guess it was a combination, because at the time I was more or less, because you were one of the other only guys that actually had his own apartment.
Yeah, you were kind of staying there.
Yeah, I was more or less living in your apartment that time, so we were really close friends.
Yeah.
So it was just a natural thing to ask you, because you were basically the best drummer in town.
But you at that time, Kung Pong was kind of, we didn't really know in what direction we should go, because we really were listening a lot more to the crusty, or maybe the late anti-CMX stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, to me, the EP is like the early sound and the later sound.
Yeah.
But we didn't write any songs or anything, so we just call it quits. Or
did you really? Because I remember it more as we hired you. You came on Millencolin, and the other guys, I think they actually saw it as that we stole you from
a little bit. Maybe we didn't. Maybe we didn't like say that. Now we quit. But
no.
Yeah. I remember going to try out playing for these guys. I brought big bottle of wine, and I'm
fucking like a gallon show these of guys wine.
I can play fast.
Yeah.
And I got the job.
You got the job.
And I guess that's the thing in Sweden, is it's like, it's not, well, maybe you guys would probably know this way better than I would, but it doesn't seem like it's as much drugs as it is alcohol in punk. Like, so many people come on this podcast and talk about, like, the drugs and the drug scene, but it's like, so much is, like, booze-fueled, like, fast-raging.
Yeah, moonshine and a lot of moonshine.
Yeah, back then, yeah.
I guess because booze is so expensive, too, right?
Yeah, and I was, I mean, drugs came in there, but I mean, Sweden was all about alcohol.
Alcohol, yeah.
Of course, yeah.
But and then, snood.
Snooze.
Yeah, snooze. That's.
Yeah, but that's like
tobacco. Cigarettes.
Yeah, yeah, tobacco.
I know. One time, on a school trip, I took a bunch of them and ate a quarter pounder and threw up all over the shower.
So yeah, that's.
It was a scared straight moment for me. Yeah. I went back to the snooze.
You're not the only one.
Yeah, you got it right. Yeah. So I wanted to kind of, like, were you as into American hardcore or the U.S. hardcore stuff as it?
Yeah, I think when I went to, like, a small festival in Sweden, in Sandviken, to watch, like, Entombed and those kind of bands, Merciless, and I found the No Control album, Bad Religion, and I fell in love with that, and yeah, all my metal friends, they told me that this sounds like country on 45, you know.
Yeah,
but I started to like that a lot. But the thrash metal scene was, you were listening to punk, hardcore crossover, and all that stuff back then.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't the guy who actually, to me it was Matthias who actually got all the albums, and I just, because I basically, when I didn't, before I was more or less living in your apartment, we always hung out in Matthias' house where his parents live, and we always stay upstairs in his, you know, room there, his boy room, and we would, and his parents would actually buy booze for us.
Oh, whoa.
And we would make orders for the weekend. I guess Fridays we would have beers, and then for the Saturday, like a small bottle of booze. So we would, Friday, Saturday, we would be there drinking, you know, in a safe sort of environment, and listen to all these music, you know. And Matthias, well, he had all this, you know, Bad Religion stuff, and later on NoFX and bands of Swedish, American, you know, Dynasty Junior. There was so many bands. We just sat there and drank and got ready to leave to that to Magget to Victoria
to the venue. Yeah,
yeah, and because that was the meeting point. So we got hammered and went on our bikes like everyone does
And actually, there's at that venue is one of the places you could find the like the underground stuff.
Yeah,
the stuff you heard on the like the skateboarding.
Yeah, yeah.
Movies, videos, and stuff. Because I mean, most people knew like Ramones and Misfits and that stuff. But once you find
the deeper cuts.
Yeah. Then, I mean, so tons of bands.
And it's so funny because, like, skateboard videos, I think that's probably where I first heard Millencolin. Like, very first time, like, you know, maybe, like, before I even knew, Mike, that you were related to him, I think it was on a skate video. Because it was just, like, such a... Skate videos were such a way of people sharing, like, music. It was, like, such a way to, like, find out about bands at the time. Like,
yeah, tons of that.
You, like, right into the late 90s. Like, it would just be like, oh, like... Quicksand, okay, this band's called Quicksand. I'll check out this band now, or, you know.
Yeah, I remember we told both Burning Heart and Epitaph, all the skateboarding, snowboarding, surfing videos, we're on it.
Mm-hmm.
We want to be there. That's our audience.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, and it was almost like the precursor to, like, the Tony Hawk video game. It's amazing how many people I've interviewed that have come on the show, and that was what got them into punk. Like, after a certain point, like, it's like, yeah, I heard bands on the Tony Hawk skateboarding game.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it was kind of like the skateboarding videos were the precursor to that.
Yeah, I guess.
So, and I was going to say, like, when sort of melodic hardcore, like the real, like, kind of like melodic hardcore sound kind of hit Sweden, was it like a divide for bands? Because there's like a bunch of bands, like, I remember there's that, I think it's the first Bad Taste comp with like A-Stream on it, and like Satanic Surfers are on it, and One Chord Wonders, I think they're called, or something like that.
Yeah.
Sick band. Okay. That band's awesome too. And then there's like, the Burning Heart skateboard team, where there's like, you know, but there's like definitely like a melodic hardcore sound that kind of hits. Was it dividing with the crust scene even more, or was it like people like jumping over and kind of like decharging their hair and buying Alien Workshop skateboards and going to shows? Did it feel like, or was it not like that at all?
I mean, just put that on. I can't speak for the crust. I mean, to me, it was during that time when we started pretty much at the same time as a few other bands.
Mm-hmm.
Like, up in the north of Sweden, you had Randy, and even before that, you had two bands. But actually, before this style sort of became, you know, big, you had Skymbex and Superdong.
I don't even know. It was
pretty much the same band. The band, the guys, Kristoffer Åström and Pelle Gunnefelt and Thomas, the singer from Breach. And
They have
Breach. I know Breach.
They have a song on the Really Fast 7.
Okay.
Yeah, Superdong. You should check that.
Yeah, well, definitely.
They were amazing. Yeah, they blew us away. We're like, this is so good.
And that's funny because like Breach is like so, like not that style at all. I remember that being the outlier on the Burning Heart compilation on Cheap Shots Volume 2, being like, oh, this is way harsher than any of the other songs.
Well, they later on started Fireside.
Oh, that same dude from Fireside too?
Well, Kristoffer Åström, Pelle Gunnefelt.
Oh, that's that dude.
And the drummer from Randy and...
holy jeez.
Guy Franz, who's other bands now. But the three bands... Well, you had Randy, you had those bands, but they started Fireside, so they left that scene.
Yeah.
I guess nothing happened, or they just... Well, I guess they discovered Quicksand.
Well, the Fireside record got reissued on a Canadian label. Like, Dine Alone Records just put out the Fireside record on Records in North America, so it had, like, a big impact here, too.
Yeah.
A different one. That's cool. But, wow, that's so weird. I had no idea that it was, like, those guys were, like, from that... Like, I guess this more kind of, like, hardcore...
Yeah, it's a town called Luleå.
Okay.
And with the big scene, Raised Fist.
That's where Raised Fist is.
But, so you had Randy, and you had those Superdong with sort of Fireside, so they didn't really play that style later than maybe 92, 93.
Yeah.
And then, so you had Randy, you had Millencolin, and you had No Fun At All,
mm-hmm.
close to us, and then Satanic Surfers. I guess we were the four bands who actually became a genre, you know, Swedish style of that Californian Epitaph sound.
And no fun at all. He had, what was his? He had a D-beat band or like a more like the singer, right? He was in like some band that was on, oh, it was on like a Looney Tunes 7-inch compilation, I think. Oh, I can't remember. I can't believe
Sober? No.
I don't know. I can't remember. But it was like pre No Fun at All, and it was like a
Their first singer was Jimmy.
Yeah.
Who later started Sober. Well, he started his own band Sober.
Okay.
And the songwriter Michael Danielson continued with No Fun at All, and they got a new singer, Ingmar.
Yeah, I thought that was the second singer that was like he was in a DB band prior to that.
Oh, maybe yeah.
Maybe I'm mistaken on that one. Anyway,
I don't know.
But when did No Fun at All form? Like 93 time two? 90?
They were probably like a year before us. They were always like a bit ahead of us in the beginning. They had their first EP out like before us, and
mm-hmm.
but so then we sort of caught up with them, like, and we for a while there when we started releasing our stuff through Burning Heart, and started touring a lot. Almost became sort of the same band because we were, you know, touring Sweden together on weekends for like half a year.
Yeah.
After we put out our first albums, right, and we went to Japan and Australia, on the, you know, together. So we did a lot of things together, and yeah.
How did Burning Heart Records like kind of? How did that whole relationship start? Because like, you know, obviously the first EP is on Burning Heart in 1994. 93. So how did that relationship with Burning Heart start? Because that kind of seems like their rise is like Millencolin's rise. Like, you know, like...
Yeah, yeah. Well, they were based in Fagersta, which is about an hour from Örebro.
Okay.
So we would go there and watch shows, because they put up a lot of shows.
Yeah, yeah.
International bands and hardcore bands, metal bands, whatever. And we would go there and... Peter, the owner of Burning Heart, he had this label Uproar Records before.
Okay.
Burning Heart, and yeah. he had a little distro in his wardrobe, so we would buy records from him. I remember ordering like Asta Kask, but he sent me Protesbank instead.
Almost.
Yeah. So it was really probably one of the first places we decided to. That's one of the places we need to get our demo tapes to. And he didn't really like us, but somebody told him that you should do something with this. You should release like an EP or something.
Really? And this was, this was the second demo tape. Because the first one we did with Matthias on drums, called Goofy.
Yeah.
And then the second one was called Milak.
Yeah. He Peter was really, really good finding bands. Because, I mean, he booked, like, Green Day, all the bands, like, the metal bands and the pop bands, Ride, Sepultura, all these bands long before they got big. And I think he actually got an offer to put out the first Offspring album, which
wow.
he turned down.
Well, but like, you know, for that mistake though, he has so many other successes.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, he found. About,
yeah, yeah, like all the bands in Sweden that he found bands, that are still like that would have like such. And it's, you know, like obviously you would know better than anyone. Like, you know, bands outside of America have such a disadvantage of like breaking internationally in punk. It seems like just because like there's such an American dominance, even from Canada, you feel like that. So like, you know, the fact that like you look at all the Burning Heart bands that. Had impact internationally, and it's like unbelievable. Like, very, I can't even think of another non-American label where it's had that kind of run of.
Yeah, and I mean, we sort of started together like at the same time, and we, the, you know, the bands and the people around the label, especially Peter, of course, I mean, made it happen, and you know, with a sort of perfect timing, everything just sort of. Matched and happened at the same time, and
did it feel like at the time like everything was like, was it, because it did it all feel like it was happening, like as it was happening, like did it feel like there was like a groundswell, like there was a different kind of, like could you notice when there was like more kids coming to the shows? And
yeah I mean, for sure, when we made a second demo, we didn't understand anything, and I think Peter didn't want to release us first because he thought my vocals was kind of out of tune and weird. That's what he told me. So but then but at the time, well, then I actually decided to release the first EP, and when we recorded that one, I think we realized that we had something good going.
Yeah.
And then, because then that sort of spread through their distribution and us playing a lot more, and I guess we realized that people actually like us, and I guess our sound was improving and my vocals also a bit, and this is late 93, and then early 94 we released the second EP, which is just two new songs and like four cover songs.
Yeah.
Operation Ivy, yeah. Descendants.
And it was funny because Rotate
Skin Back and
Rotate This would get all those EPs in. On my shelf I've got like all the old CD EPs still.
Yeah.
That they would get in because it was like they would order them in at and you would get this stuff there, and it was like, and it was crazy because they'd all have this little like Burning Heart logo on the back of all these records, and you'd be like, this is like the most perfect scene.
Yeah.
Another band that I don't know, that I always thought was weird from that scene was, and maybe they came a little later, actually I know they probably came later, was Pride Bowl. They had that American guy singing for them too.
Aaron Golden.
Yeah, he was like a pro wakeboarder or something, a pro surfboarder.
He was surfing, so he actually lived down in Varberg where we have the best surf.
Okay, yeah.
In Sweden.
Well, I honestly, we've just scratched the surface, but I don't want to keep you guys here all day because you have limited time in Toronto and family to talk to, but this has been fucking awesome. Hopefully we get to tour Australia again and we can do a much longer version of this, because this has been awesome. Like, we haven't even talked about all the other things you guys did, and we haven't even talked about
that's how we started. But you said, you were asking me about like the sort of changing point.
Yeah.
And when we released the second EP around that time in springtime 94, we played at up in Fagersta at Dala, Bergslagsrocken, sorry, the festival created by Peter and his sort of entourage up there. And that year NoFX played, we played, and we played this like really super lagwagon played on.
Gwar.
Yeah.
Snapcase.
Rancid. Or maybe
Lagwagon?
Lagwagon, yeah. So it was, and to that festival, people came from...
What a show. Did Frodis play that too or something?
They might have.
Yeah, and then, or Sam.
Yeah, because I think when Jason from Frodis was on, he talked about,
about
how crazy that show was.
This festival happened like every year for...
Yeah.
5 years or I don't know.
Something like that.
Yeah, and this was for us the first time, so it was a massive thing for us to actually play there. And we played this like this smallest stage, which was just like a trailer that they opened up, but that was the first show where we had audience that went sort of berserk and crazy, and we just saw, you know, people from Refuse sort of stage diving and
yeah.
And you know, we just realized that, and Fat Mike was there in a wheelchair watching us, and like afterwards like I like your EP and whatever he said, and I was like, we just realized that something is happening here.
And and Burning Heart, they had close contact with Epitaph.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Burning Heart set us up with a booking agent and stuff, so it went pretty fast for us starting the tour Sweden, and then we got like a support tour to Pennywise in Europe.
What was that tour like?
It was one of the most craziest tours I've been to. That's another story.
Yeah, that's another story.
probably several other stories, I can imagine.
But from there, it sort of took off. But
Yeah, like, I guess, as I say, like, I wanted to talk to you guys all day, but you have limited time in the city, and this room is friggin' hot with all three of us in here, four of us in here. But this has been awesome. Thank you guys so much for coming down here. This is amazing.
Thank you, man.
And it's amazing to get to talk to you. Mike, good to see you again. And yeah, let's talk records now off air.
Yeah.
Thank you, Nicola, and thank you, Frederick, for coming on the show. That was a awesome experience to get to do that. And, you know, maybe I'm going to have to do part 2 and 3 and have them on separately next time. Or maybe Matthias, you know, there's a lot of plans. I love that band, and there's a lot more that I want to discuss for sure in the future. And great to see Mike again. Thank you, Mike, for bringing him over. Yeah, let's, you know what? Live your dreams, kids. Live your dreams. Because as I said there, one day you too can have your favorite band from Sweden hanging out in your room that is overstuffed with demo tapes and records. But hey. Speaking of living your dreams, next week on the show, I got to thank Shara for making this happen because she worked tirelessly to coordinate the two schedules and make this thing work. Because next week on the show, in light of her amazing new book, we have Brix Smith from The Fall. If for those of you who are unfamiliar with Brix, Brix is a, I don't know, post-punk legend, punk legend, and she has an incredible story, and she has an amazing book, which is due out now, and I just finished reading it, and it is incredible. It's called her memoir, The Rise, The Fall, and The Rise. It is an incredible read, a person who has lived a memoir-worthy life, as I describe it next week. I cannot hype this one up enough, people. So please tune in next week for an incredible episode with Brix Smith. Thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did making it. Once again, if you would like to support this podcast, please tell your friends, subscribe to this, write a review, and rate it, if you will. Also, check out Footnotes, check out Clobber and Time, check out the stuff I do at Vice, if you were very interested in doing that. Damien Abraham, you just search that. It'll come up for you. Find me on social media, @LeffordDamien. And that's it. I'll see you on Footnotes. This will be a great Footnotes. Can't wait to talk about Super Dong with Chris. Oh my God. Check out Super Dong. Thanks, everyone. Go out there and make your own culture, and I'll see you next week. It's a really awkward ending to the show there. Super Dong into that. But anyway, fuck it.